From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Whenever any of them spoke through the mask, the muslin bulged and grew moist over the lips. This gave a sort of unreality to the conversation. It was like a colloquy of statues. Well, the shocking beauty of that passage is what reveals the horror contained in the story it tells. The words belong to Albert Camus from his great 1947 novel, The Plague. Well, this time around, we have the binge-watching delights of Netflix and Hulu to distract us. But does re-watching every episode of Tiger King really help us cope? Really help us understand and see our way through to whatever lies on the other side of the curve? Nope. We have to slow down to do that. We've got to read. Especially fiction. There's something about seeing an imaginary plague unfold on the page that I think can help us come to grips with our all-too-real lives now. So today, we're going to talk with three best-selling authors about what we can learn from pandemic fiction. And the first of those authors is Lawrence Wright. He joins us from Austin, Texas. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda, and The Road to 9/11, and also of God Save Texas, amongst others. His new novel is called The End of October, and it follows an epidemiologist in the midst of a pandemic, and the book came out just last month. Lawrence Wright, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Magnus. Good to be with you again.
Geraldine Brooks is our second author. She also joins us. She's in Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author as well of March and Caleb's Crossing. Her best-selling novel from 2001 called Years of Wonders, A Novel of the Plague, tells the story of bubonic plague as it unfolds in rural England. Geraldine Brooks, welcome to you.
Hi, Meghna.
It's wonderful to talk with you again, Geraldine. And finally, last but definitely not least, is Tom Perotta. He's joining us from Belmont, Massachusetts, author of many bestsellers, including Election and Little Children. His 2011 novel, The Leftovers, reimagines a rapture-like event where 2% of the world's population suddenly disappears. That novel was adapted into an HBO television series. Tom Perotta, welcome to you.
Hi, Meghna.
Okay, so Lawrence, I'm just going to start with you, actually. A couple of years ago when you started writing what became The End of October, did you know something that we didn't know?
Well, I had been talking to a lot of people in public health, and they certainly knew that, you know, we were going to have another pandemic. It was going to be bad. And they couldn't tell me when, but they knew it would happen one day. So, yes, I was alert to that. I didn't know that it would coincide with the publication of my book.
Well, so tell us a little bit about the story that unfolds in The End of October.
This is, the hero is Henry Parsons, and he's an epidemiologist with the CDC in Atlanta. And he's at a convention at a WHO in Geneva. And there's a report about an outbreak, a very fatal outbreak in a detention camp in Indonesia. And the report is a little sketchy, and Henry's suspicious. So the director of the World Health Organization asked him to go check out what's happening. And what he finds there is a new disease, one that has never been seen before. And as an epidemiologist, he knows how dangerous such a thing is.
Okay, so I want to dig into each one of your books in more detail, but I'll spread it out over the course of the hour. So let's jump back in time, though. Geraldine, your book, Years of Wonders, has to do with the bubonic plague. What was it about that plague from centuries ago that you found such fertile ground for fiction?
Well, this is the true story. The novel is based on the true story of what actually happened in a tiny village in Derbyshire when bubonic plague was carried from London, probably in a bolt of cloth that had been ordered by an itinerant tailor visiting the village. And what's remarkable is that as the plague took hold, the villagers took as far as I've been able to research, the unique decision to voluntarily quarantine themselves to arrest the spread of infection into surrounding communities. And I stumbled literally upon this story quite by chance when I was on a hike in the Peak District in Derbyshire, and I saw a sign saying Plague Village. And I thought, that's funny. Not many places try to attract tourists by putting up signs advertising the plague. But I went there, and in the church, they had a display of what had taken place in this year of quarantine. And the story was so touching and terrible, it took hold of my imagination. And years later, when I was finished with being a foreign correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, I decided to go back and see if I could tell that story.
Wow. Okay, I can already tell you I see the big challenge of this hour, and that is each one of you, we could talk about your individual books for multiple hours. So you're going to have to forgive me if I sort of bounce in between you a little bit here. Tom, now your book doesn't The Leftovers isn't strictly about a plague, but it is about the sudden absence of people, which I think definitely resonates with folks. I mean, what do you think about what we're experiencing now and the kind of world and reactions that you brought to life in your book?
Yeah, you know, The Leftovers is really an aftermath story. It takes place 3 years after this event that in which 2% of the world's population disappeared. And it's really about the way that a large-scale event like this reverberates and what the emotional and psychological cost of a large collective trauma is. And, you know, what's been interesting for me is I thought it was the opposite of a pandemic, you know, because in The Leftovers, this thing happens and science can't explain it and religion can't explain it, and it creates a vacuum. And the story is really about how people rush in to fill that vacuum with new religious forms and new stories and pseudoscientific theories. And I thought that's the opposite of a pandemic, where we have something that scientists do understand. But you can see already that the trauma that we've suffered so far has created a space for you know, all kinds of pseudoscience and wishful thinking.
Yeah, so tell me more about that, because I was actually just going to ask you that exact same question. We are seeing the pseudoscience rush into the vacuum. Is that just a very human thing, or is it specific to the handling of this moment and this pandemic?
Well, I think the problem is science understands what's happening, but science doesn't know how to fix it. And so I do think that that's where the vacuum is. I mean, there are obviously brilliant scientists who are working really hard to create a vaccine, but until that actually happens, I think you'll just see a lot of the wishful thinking and crackpot theorizing that we've been getting
right
in the past few weeks.
Well, and the other thing that you write so brilliantly in The Leftovers is the suddenness, the trauma that comes from the suddenness of change. Have you felt that in reality right now?
I think it's that that thing that Fitzgerald talked about in The Great Gatsby of, you know, or was it the gradually then suddenly? You know, it snuck up slowly. I remember the night before we were told to stay home, I was out you know, at a bar listening to music, and, you know, we were shoulder to shoulder and people were joking about the virus. And then suddenly the next day we were locked in our homes. And so there was just this very slow buildup and then this plunge into a new reality that I think we're still in shock. I think it's still the shock period.
Yeah. So a little later in the show, I'm going to ask you to read an excerpt from The Leftovers and Geraldine as well from Year of Wonders. But Larry Wright, let me hop back over to you here. What do you think it is about pandemics, about disease and human reaction, human social reaction to it, that's such fertile ground for writers?
Well, you know, there are some wonderful books, as you point out, but what's really distinctive about pandemics and, you know, horrible disease outbreaks in the past is how little was made out of them. How little remark they are in human consciousness. This was true even in the plague years. Even Chaucer just has a sketchy mention of it, and Shakespeare. I mean, people that actually lived in those times. And after 1918, for instance, you know, a disease that killed more Americans, 675,000, it is estimated, than all the American soldiers that died in all the wars in the 20th century. And yet that was completely purged from consciousness. So we have, you know, some, like Pale Horse, Pale Rider is a wonderful book about the 1918 flu. But there's very little other than that. And, you know, I think that this plague fiction really stands out by, is marked by its scarcity in many respects.
By its scarcity. Geraldine, would you agree?
Yeah. I mean, it's fascinating to me that in Shakespeare's time, they had to close the theaters regularly. You know, every other summer they would close the theaters, and that was about the only time he went home to Stratford. And in fact, his young son, Hamnet, died of the plague, and that year he wrote The Merry Wives of Windsor. So it was very much, I think, a given of human experience that this happened.
It's so interesting because even though there, the as Lawrence says, there may be a scarcity of pandemic literature or fiction, I think our minds are just so focused on it right now, given what we're experiencing. I mean, Tom, are pandemic books of fiction on your reading list?
Yeah. And, you know, I'm reading Camus' The Plague, which you mentioned before, and I think it's, you know, what's so interesting about that in relation to what Lawrence just said is that for a long time, people wanted to see the plague as an allegory about fascism rather than a very literal story about the plague. And, you know, in I'm about halfway through right now, and it feels very literally about the experience of a plague. And it so I think in some ways people just wanted to resist that part of it and see it as a political metaphor rather than, you know, really devastating examination of the powerlessness of that people feel in the midst of a disease that's killing them and that they can't stop.
Yeah. Well, we are talking this hour with three best-selling authors, Tom Perata, Geraldine Brooks, and Lawrence Wright, about pandemic fiction and what it is that literature can do to help us understand the reality of this moment. There's much more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. I have the privilege of speaking with three best-selling authors today about pandemic fiction and why literature, or how literature, can help us navigate the truth of our current reality. I'm joined by Tom Perata. His novel, The Leftovers, imagines a rapture-like event where 2% of the world population suddenly disappears. That was also adapted into an HBO TV series. Lawrence Wright joins us as well. He's author of many books. His latest is The End of October, which just came out last month, and it is about an epidemiologist attempting to battle a pandemic caused by a mysterious virus. And Geraldine Brooks is also with us as well, the author of many novels, including Year of Wonders, a novel of the plague, a historical adaptation of what happened in a real English village during the bubonic plague. And Geraldine, I wonder, this might be a great moment to actually hear a little bit from Year of Wonders. Could you read an excerpt of the book for us?
Sure, I'd love to, Meghna. This is, the book is narrated by Anna, who is a young widow of a lead miner, and she works for the vicar of the town who has led them to make the decision to quarantine themselves. And this is her describing the town a year into their quarantine. We have always built here with what we have to hand, so our walls are hewn of the common grey stone and the roofs thatched with heather. Behind the cottages on either side of the road lie tilled fields and grazing commons, but these end abruptly in a sudden rise or fall of ground. The looming edge to the north of us its sheer stone face sharply marking the end of settled land and the beginning of the moors, and to the south, the swift, deep dip of the dale. It is a strange prospect, our main street these days. I used to rue its dustiness in summer and muddiness in winter, the rain all risen in the wheel ruts, making glassy hazards for the unwary stepper. But now there is neither ice nor mud nor dust, for the road is grassed over, with just a cow track down the center where the slight use of a few passing feet has worn the weeds down. For hundreds of years, the people of this village pushed nature back from its precincts. It has taken less than a year to begin to reclaim its place. In the very middle of the street, a walnut shell lies broken, and from it already sprouts a sapling that wants to grow up to block our way entire. I have watched it from its first seed leaves, wondering when someone would pull it out. No one has yet done so, and now it stands already a yard high. Footprints testify that we are all walking around it. I wonder if it is indifference or whether, like me, others are so brimful of endings that they cannot bear to wrench even a scrawny sapling from its tenuous grip on life.
That's Geraldine Brooks reading an excerpt from her 2001 novel, Year of Wonders, a novel of the plague. Geraldine, it's remarkable that this, in reality, this vision, this village self-quarantined. I wonder what that fact and your subsequent investigation, you know, of the village, how you reflect on that given where we are all now under what would, I think, safely be called not a self-quarantine.
Not a self-quarantine, and quite a controversial one. You know, I think the thing that is so remarkable about the Eam story is that the villagers came together there and made this act of self-sacrifice at terrible cost to themselves, I should add. You know, probably two-thirds of the population died there in that year when they were having their supplies delivered to the edge of the town and not leaving. And whereas some of those people, had they fled, they could have saved their own lives. But on the other hand, not one outbreak of bubonic plague was ever traced back to the Eam outbreak. So it was a self-sacrifice that saved many, many lives. And it's fascinating to me thinking about being able to bring a community to consensus, because we can't get consensus on anything here, even how many cars should be allowed in the parking lot at the beach right now. You know, every single thing turns into a pretty acrimonious debate. And I think it just testifies to visions that we've allowed to happen in our society.
Right. And so the fundamental truth that's also we see in each of your works of fiction, historical and more contemporary, is that these are moments, pandemics show us who we are, right? I mean, Lawrence Wright, that's got to be part of the theme of the end of October.
That's true. And, you know, it's certainly in real life, the life we're having this very moment, I think there's something about wars and depressions and pandemics that are like x-rays of the society that you live in, and it allows you to see all the way through to the faults inside. And right now, I think, you know, just as in the novel that I wrote, we are actually at a crossroads, and you know, we have a lot of work to do when this finally passes. We, I think, see all the shortcomings in our society and the partisanship, the lack of accountability, the budget cuts that have so hampered our health agencies and so on. All of these are going to have to be addressed, and it'll be up to us to take on that challenge, and I hope we are able to meet it.
Okay, so Larry, let me ask you, the last time we talked was about your book about Texas and its marvelous idiosyncrasies, if I can just put it that way. And you've also obviously reported on and written extensively on 9/11 as well. I just wonder, given that your particular journalistic x-rays that you've applied to society at different points in time. How much did that flow into how you approach writing The End of October about what a modern day, you know, a fictional view version of a modern day pandemic? How much did that inform the novel?
Well, you know, I researched the medicine, but I also researched the politics and the geopolitics. And my technique was to examine, you know, the world we live in, the fractures that, you know, the rivalries, the, you know, the sort of sub wars that are going on, you know, cyber wars and so on. And imagine if I just added pressure, stress in the form of a pandemic, what would happen then? So in some respects, it's like journalism. A reporter normally asks, what happened? And the step I took was, what would happen?
Well, it's an incredibly gripping book, I have to say.
Thank you, Geraldine.
It just, to be reading it right now, I mean, it's a very dire place that you go to, but I love the way you land the ending.
Oh, thank you.
But don't give it away right now, though, Larry.
Please.
I mean, Tom, those stresses that Larry Wright was talking about, just your thoughts about that?
Yeah, you know, I think, The Leftovers takes place 3 years after the event,
yeah,
and
yeah.
It spawns these entirely new cultural phenomena. I think what's happening right now is that the pandemic is being subsumed into our culture war. And so what we're seeing is, you know, that narrative is still really strong. But it may be that a couple of years from now, we'll look back at this and say, oh, this was where, you know, there was a turning point where we decided that, you know, everybody needed health care, or this was the moment when, you know, a generation found its political identity. You know, I just think, or there might even be, you know, new religious expressions that emerge from it. We're just not there yet. Right now, what we're seeing is what Lawrence just talked about, which is pre-existing problems in our political body are being revealed.
So if we were all actually lucky enough to be able to sit at the same table together, this might be a little easier. But I just want to throw out some questions and have any of you respond to them. So if it's a little messy, it's just live radio in the middle of a pandemic. We're just going to have to deal with it. But to Tom's point about the pandemic being subsumed by the culture war or the other illnesses that were already in our body politic, I mean, is that a theme that all three of you sort of negotiated or used in the writing of your three books about your fictional pandemics?
My book was set at a time when science and superstition was still fighting it out, you know. So it was 1665. You had Isaac Newton inventing calculus, but you also had witches still being hanged in Scotland. So, and I would have thought we had moved on from there, but unfortunately, the rise of all this crackpot, superstitious, anti-vaxxer, deep state is coming for our liberties craziness makes me think we haven't really moved on at all.
Well, I agree with that, Geraldine, and it's very distressing to see, for instance, the geopolitical rivalries at a time when we should all be united to try to overcome what is a universal disease. And instead, you know, we're inching toward war. And, you know, it's crazy that we should be in such a status right now. If there's anything that should be unifying, it is our own mortal threat that hangs over us right now.
Yeah, instead there's this dangerous reversion to otherizing. You know, I think we've got very tribal.
Yes, that's right.
You know, I think some of those tensions that you're talking about are, you know, international. But I think other times they are really, you know, also within ourselves. Like one of the things that I thought about a lot in The Leftovers was, you know, that the town I was studying or the town I was, you know, writing about, there was a division between people who were plunged into despair and felt like they were living in an entirely new world. and people who just wanted to go back to the way it was. They liked their lives the way it was. And you just feel that impulse now, too. You know, we want to go back to the way it was because we liked the way it was better than we'd liked it now. And that might be wishful thinking, but that's a very powerful urge in people.
Well, I wonder if it's a powerful urge because it asks a lot of us to imagine what a new reality is going to be like. I'll be perfectly honest. It taxes my abilities. It's beyond my capacity to think what will our new lives be like, which is why we need fiction, which is why we need literature, I think, because we need your imaginations to help see us through. And so I wonder, when writing these books about events and scenarios that are all-encompassing, that touch a giant swath of humanity, practically speaking, Geraldine, I'll start with you. How do you decide who the narrator is going to be or what point of view you're going to take?
For me, this was my first novel. Before I wrote this, I'd worked solely in journalism, but I was lucky enough to come across one of the few written records from the year of plague itself, because most of the villagers were illiterate shepherds or lead miners, and they didn't leave an account. But the minister had written a few letters, and one of them mentioned his maid and said, "Fortunately, my maid continued in health, which was a blessing." And I tried to find out who that person had been, but of course she was lost to us and we didn't have anything, even a name. So I made her up and I made her my narrator because I thought she could see into both the ordinary life of the village that she belonged to, but in her position with the minister who was the leader of the village, she could see the elite. Mm-hmm. As well. Mm-hmm. And so that was why she was a good voice.
Yeah. And Tom, what about you?
You know, I tried to create a microcosm studying this one small suburban town and really focusing on this one family. And no one in the family disappeared, but the mother is plunged into such despair that she joins a nihilistic cult, and the father is the mayor of the town, and he is just trying to get things back to normal. And so this divide that I was seeing between, despair and hope and between creating a new social reality or trying to restore the old one, I tried to find that, locate that in the family that I was writing about.
Yeah. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. And Larry, for your book, how did you decide what point of view to take or how to walk the reader through this?
Well, it's not so easy in our time to create heroes, but in immersing myself in the world of public health, I saw them all around me. And I think we're all aware of that now. And the name Henry Parsons, that's the name of my hero, was taken from a 19th century epidemiologist, a country doctor and botanist who was appointed a deputy health director during an influenza outbreak in London in the 1890s. And at the time, it was thought that influenza was caused by miasmas, environmental gases, And Henry Parsons was the first person to conclusively demonstrate that it spread by contagion. It was a major milestone in the history of epidemiologists by a little-known personality. So to tip my hat to him and to some extent imbue my own hero with some of his characteristics, I appropriated Henry Parsons for myself.
Wow. Well, we're getting a lot of comments coming in online about what folks are reading. Linda Luke says, "I'm so excited about the show. I read Year of Wonders when it was first published many years ago and have never forgotten how powerful it was." And Linda's also got a 3-generation pandemic book group going on in her family right now. Liberati Wellness, someone calling themselves Liberati Wellness, says, "Currently reading Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel. The survival mechanism to repress reality on the outset of a pandemic in the book resonates with the denial we see in many people during the coronavirus pandemic." I think that's something that all three of you just talked about. So we'll dig into that more about how denial plays a role in both what we're experiencing now and how you thought through it in your various works of fiction. So, folks, today we are talking with three best-selling authors. Lawrence Wright, who's author of The End of October, a pandemic fiction novel that just came out last month. Geraldine Brooks is also with us. Her best-selling novel, Year of Wonders, a novel of the plague, was first published in 2001. And Tom Perata joins us as well. His novel, The Leftovers, was first published in 2011. We've got a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Do you find yourself searching for true crime podcasts that are different from what you're always recommended? Do you want to make a real difference in the cases that you're following? Well, you're a crime junkie. And I'm Ashley Flowers, the creator and host of the number one true crime podcast, Crime Junkie. There are hundreds of episodes already available, and each Monday we dive into the details of cases spanning from some of the most infamous to those that you have never heard covered before. Listen to Crime Junkie podcast now, wherever you're listening.
Smart journalism, fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the program, since it is going to be Friday, it will be our week in review, and we want to know what your questions are about the world and the news this week. Are you one of the 36 million Americans who've lost their jobs recently? What do you want and need from the next congressional aid package if it happens? And what do you make of Dr. Anthony Fauci's extremely cautious outlook for the fall? Call us with your questions and your stories and your experiences at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. We'll use it for tomorrow's show in our week in review. Today, we are talking with three best-selling authors about pandemic literature. And I'm joined by Lawrence Wright. He's with us from Austin, Texas, Pulitzer Prize-winning author and journalist, author of many novels. His latest, which just came out last month, is called The End of October, and it follows an epidemiologist attempting to battle a pandemic caused by a mysterious virus. Geraldine Brooks also joins us. She's with us from Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts, Pulitzer Prize-winning author and journalist. Her best-selling novel in 2001 was called Year of Wonders, a novel of the plague. And Tom Perata also joins us. He's with us from Belmont, Massachusetts, best-selling novelist and screenwriter. You probably remember, you most certainly remember his 2011 novel, The Leftovers. And Tom, I think this is a great moment for us to hear a little bit from The Leftovers. If you could read for us, I'd love that.
Yeah, you know, my son was in Harvard Square right when the lockdown happened, and he was telling me that he just saw people, college students, just burst into tears because I think they'd just gotten the word that school was being closed. And it reminded me of this section in The Leftovers. My character, Tom Garvey, is a freshman in college, and the event, the sudden departure, happens on October 14th, and then this is what happens. School was canceled on October 15th. They were given 7 days to pack up their stuff and vacate the campus. That final week existed in his memory as a blur of baffled farewells, the dorm slowly emptying, the muffled sound of someone crying behind a closed door, the soft curses people uttered as they pocketed their phones. There were a few desperate parties, one of which ended in a sickening brawl, and a hastily arranged memorial service at the dome, at which the chancellor solemnly recited the names of the university's victims of what people had just begun to call the sudden departure. Tom hadn't done anything wrong, but he remembered feeling a weird sense of shame, of personal failure, returning home so soon after he'd left, almost as if he'd flunked out or gotten expelled for disciplinary reasons. But there was comfort as well, the reassurance of returning to his family, finding them all present and accounted for. They hunkered down for a couple of weeks, just the four of them, watching TV and playing board games, anything to distract them from the hysterical monotony of the TV news, the obsessive repetition of the same few basic facts, the ever-rising tally of the missing, interview upon interview with traumatized eyewitnesses. Tom didn't mind being home at first. It made sense at a time like that for people to stick close to their loved ones. There was an almost unbearable tension in the air, a mood of anxious waiting, though no one seemed to know whether they were waiting for a logical explanation or a second wave of disappearances. It was as if the whole world had paused to take a deep breath and steel itself for whatever was going to happen next.
That's Tom Perata reading from his 2011 novel, The Leftovers. You know, in the case of all of your novels, I have to remind myself that this is fiction, because it does seem to hit so close to home in terms of how people are responding right now. That anxious waiting for, we're not even quite sure what, even in this case, in the coronavirus pandemic.
Yeah, I think that's the hard part about being in the middle of it, because we don't know if we're in the middle of it. And that makes, I think this is one of the comforting things about reading fiction, right, is that the whole story is there and there's an end to it and there's a way to make sense of it. And right now, we don't know if we're in the middle of the story, the beginning of the story, near the end of the story. I don't think we're near the end. And that sense that there's going to be a second wave, that this is just the beginning, is just so hard even to contemplate. And so on top of just, I think, the trauma of now, there's just this dread of the future that is laid on top of it. Mm-hmm.
You know, in the last segment, I truly enjoyed actually hearing the three of you talk with each other until I butted in again. So I'm going to encourage you to do that once more. And let me just sort of set up this question that I'm absolutely fascinated to hear all of you walk us through. Did writing these books and the research that you had to do and the effort that it took to sort of imagine yourself into the worlds of your narrators, did it help you? Do you think it helped you prepare for surviving and experiencing this real moment now? And I'll just start by asking Larry Wright, what do you think about that?
Well, to some extent, Meghna, I guess the end of January, I ordered mask and gloves. I just knew that a virus like this wasn't going to be contained. There was no way that it was going to stop, no matter, you know, what the president said or, you know, how we reacted. And until we reacted as soberly and sternly as China, it was going to be all over America. And we're just not that kind of country. So, and then stocking up on food and so on, but I didn't sell my stocks, so I missed that one. I was worried, and I was counseling my family and my friends, that they should, take it seriously, and a friend of mine got ill in February, and it didn't seem at the time to be COVID-19, but it turned out that it was.
Geraldine?
I don't know, whether imagining grief really prepares you for grief. Mm-hmm. So my protagonist and narrator experiences the complete nightmare of losing both her babies, children to the plague. And my older son was a baby at the time I was writing it. And everything I wrote describing her children was something I had observed in my own child. And yet I had to, kill off these children that were both based on my child. And it was harrowing, but I don't know that the act of imagination, whether our imaginative empathy really extends to the experience. To me, the most frightening thing about this disease is the idea of people having to die alone. This is something I didn't imagine, because nobody in my village has to die alone. They support each other. But the idea that if you go to the hospital, you may never see the people you love again, I think is the real terror of the situation we're living through now.
Hmm.
Yeah, I think we are people who live in always in a state of denial, whether it's the denial of our own mortality or that's really at the heart of it. We're just really good at it. I think we all knew that something like this was possible. We've had other near misses with diseases recently, and then there was the Ebola outbreak. We know it's there, but it's a little bit like maybe being diagnosed with a serious illness. It's always a possibility in your mind, but when it happens, it still hits like a sledgehammer.
And I still think we're in possibly catastrophic denial regarding climate change, but the one thing that I hope comes out of this time is that we've seen that it's possible to absolutely do anything. I mean, you can stop the economy if you need to. Whereas before we were being told, no, you can't close down a coal mine. That's impossible. Well, we've seen you can do what you need to do. And hopefully we'll hold that thought.
I wonder about this too, Geraldine. I thought about how during the Depression, the Great Depression, America completely remade its society in the middle of it, making it stronger and more cohesive and more compassionate. And World War II, again, America reinvented itself. But I don't know that we're still that same country. After 9/11, I felt that we'd have to regain our greatness and become the country that our parents had bequeathed us. But instead, we invaded Iraq and tortured people in Guantanamo. And, we became a country that in some ways I couldn't recognize. This is an opportunity, I think, once again, to reinvent America. And we can do it in profound and helpful ways, but we can also screw it up as we have in the past.
I just was going to give you guys a couple of seconds to respond to that because, Larry, this is something that I think has been the driving ethos of our show over the past couple of months now, which is the pandemics hold up a mirror to who we are. And we, all three of you have actually mentioned that today, both in reality in terms and also the ideas that you explore in your novels. The question is, do we like what the mirror is reflecting back to us? And if we don't, what do we do about it? And we've got questions here actually coming in online. Laura Rossi says the interviews powerfully show both the lessons of history through the lens of literature and fiction and our role as part of a history, that role happening in real time. So what are the author's thoughts about the lessons that history has for 2020? Geraldine, do you have a response to that?
Well, I think one thing that I learned first as a journalist, and it drives most of my fiction, is the question of who are you when the crisis comes? Are you drawn towards your best self or your worst self? And I think you can expand that out to the society. Will we be our best self or our worst self? And I think that answer is still hanging in the air. We don't know. You look at a country like New Zealand that has been incredibly cohesive, and I think, they've got something like a total of 50 deaths because of their willingness to go early, go hard, and really make big sacrifices, and that worked out for them. Mm. And the lack of cohesion here, I think, is very costly.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Tom, I didn't know if you wanted to respond to that as well.
In The Leftovers, 2% of the population disappears, and there's a real sort of split over whether that is a loss that can be absorbed. And I think we're in that moment right now of just trying to think about, what is more important, saving lives or getting the economy started up, and how do we value the lives of older people or sicker people? And, we have various you know, religious traditions, and we have ethical ideas. But I think, you know, we're in the thick of this debate, which is how much do we value the lives of our fellow citizens? And it's going to be the acid test for us.
Yeah.
And particularly, you know, black and brown citizens who are suffering disproportionately.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, our listeners are responding quite powerfully to this hour. Several comments coming in online about things that people are reading right now. Jeremiah Murphy is rereading Love in the Time of Cholera. Of course, that's Gabriel Garcia Marquez's great book. Elizabeth Dahl says, In the Shadow of Blackbirds by Kat Winters, an excellent, well-researched, prize-winning YA novel set during the 1918 flu pandemic. And then Clinton Nichols talks about Blindness by the late Nobel laureate Jose Saramago. That one is about an epidemic of blindness and how folks try to survive the social collapse. So not death there, but just the robbing of sight. A really, really interesting book. Now, we've got 2 minutes left here. So my last question to all of you, Tom, you actually began to answer this earlier about what you're reading now. You mentioned Camus and the Plague. Just really briefly for all three of you, and Tom, I'll begin with you. What else is on your reading list?
Well, I was in the middle of the Robert Caro Passage of Power, and I put it down to pick up the Plague.
Okay, so put history down to pick up the Plague. Geraldine Brooks, what's on your reading list right now?
Well, I just finished Larry's book, and now I've decided to delve back into the past, reading Middlemarch.
Fascinating. Okay, and Lawrence Wright, what's on your reading list?
Well, I've gone way back into the past, and I'm still locked into Plague stuff. I'm reading The Decameron by Boccaccio, and it's quite fascinating. It's about a group of 10 friends from Florence sheltering in place during the plague, and they tell the most ribald stories. But you can actually see the Middle Ages fading away in their stories as the Renaissance looms over the horizon.
Right. And so they flee to the hills near Florence to tell each other stories. Interestingly, I think I've heard that there's a contemporary version of that going on. The Florentines are writing a brand new Decameron.
Really? That's great.
So perhaps we will have a whole body of profound new literature coming out of our collective experience of this plague. But I just cannot thank the three of you enough for joining us this hour. Lawrence Wright, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of many novels. His newest is called The End of October. It came out just last month. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And Geraldine Brooks, also a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer and journalist. Her novel from 2001 is called The Year of Wonders, a novel of the plague. It's a historical adaptation of what happened in a village during the bubonic plague in rural England. Geraldine, what a pleasure to speak with you again. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Meghna.
And Tom Perata, best-selling novelist and screenwriter. In 2011, he published The Leftovers, which reimagined a rapture-like event where 2% of the world's population suddenly disappeared. Tom, it was great to have you on the program. Thank you.
Thank you, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.